You're listening to Joey Ritter Live at joeyritter.com. Also on Twitter at Joey Ritter.
All right, joeyritter.com, on Twitter at Joey Ritter. Very excited about my guest today. I've got legendary NHL broadcaster and Stanley Cup winner, Bill Clement. Bill, it is an honor to have you on the show. Thank you for doing this.
Great to be on with you. I finally get to see what the man behind the curtain looks like.
That would be me, yes.
or shall I say in front of the curtain?
Yes, yeah, I think you saw my email signature where I'm hiding my face a little bit, but I'm right here front and center.
All right. Now,
Bill, according to my extensive research on Wikipedia and Google Maps, you're from Buckingham, Quebec. Is that correct?
You know, I was born in Buckingham, but I'm actually from a town that's 14 miles from Buckingham. The reason I was born in Buckingham is there was no hospital in Thurso, Quebec. And just to point out, the most notable, I guess, NHLer to ever come out of Buckingham was Claude Lemieux. And the most notable NHLer to ever come out of Thurso, Quebec, my hometown, was not, in fact, me. It was Hall of Famer Guy Lafleur.
I would say, you know, I'd say you're here, maybe Guy's just maybe right here, but close.
Yeah, figure, huh?
Yeah.
Nose is growing, Joey.
What's that?
Your nose is growing.
So I would assume, now I looked that up on Google Maps, and it's about an hour and a half from Montreal, so I would assume you grew up a Habs fan?
Actually, I grew up a Maple Leafs fan.
Now, how does that work?
I don't know. Well, we got equal coverage. We only got one game a week when I was a kid. And it was Montreal one week and Toronto another week. And when I started watching, Toronto was actually a better team. And my brother liked red, so he liked Montreal. And we used to battle all the time. He's 3 years younger than I am, but he was the Montreal fan, and I was the Toronto fan. Nevertheless, I held both franchises in great reverence, hoping to be able to play there one day.
So you grew up a Leafs fan, and you did play there one day at the Maple Leaf Gardens, right?
Yeah, I did, but you know what? Even though I wasn't a Montreal fan, the Forum was really the Vatican of hockey, and it was really an intense emotional feeling. Not only the first time I played as a visiting player in the Forum, I never played for Montreal, so I was always a visiting player, but not only was it really an eerie, kind of different, almost unnerving feeling the first time I played in there, but it was like that for a number of games. It took me a while to get comfortable playing there.
Really? So what do you have to do to get comfortable? Is it just a matter of playing over and over? Or, I mean, what makes it uncomfortable? The fans or just, you know, the anxiety of being in the building to begin with?
Well, a couple of things. The aura, you know, the mystique that surrounded it. And at that time, Montreal had really good teams. So you were always playing against, in the 70s, you were always playing against really powerful Montreal teams. So the aura of the Montreal Forum, there's so much history there. The fact that it was close to my hometown, but also the fact that I had more friends and family see me play in the Montreal Forum than any other building. So I was always conscious of the fact that I had family there. There were always distractions when I played there because I had to see family the night before. Not that I minded seeing mom and dad and brother or sister, but you get into a routine as a player and you have to kind of break that routine, lining up tickets, making sure you see people before the game, the day of the game, after the game. So in that sense, my routine was broken. So I think I had to adjust to that broken routine for a few years.
Okay, yeah. Now, is it weird seeing your family after a game if you either played well or, I guess, if you played bad or if the team lost and then you have to face your family?
Right.
Do you really have to, you know, grow thick skin and be able to smile, or, you know, do you just kind of say, kind of give a don't talk to me vibe and they respect it? I mean, what's that like?
By the time I made it to the NHL, they kind of already understood that don't talk to me vibe. You know, they kind of got that. But, you know, you put on a happy face because it's your family. But the truth is, it sucked seeing anybody that cared about you if you played poorly or you lost. I mean, our whole self-esteems in the era that I grew up in were kind of attached to our performance. Organizations and coaches and general managers, they didn't want us to feel any good about ourselves when we lost. And we didn't anyway because we were, you know, kind of trained thoroughbreds. We knew when we had won, we knew when we had lost.
And so 1982 was the end of your playing career. I don't quite know when you started broadcasting. Can you take me through that transition period between when you stopped playing and when you started broadcasting?
Well, it requires more than a minute, but I'll give it to you in less than a minute. When I retired in Calgary, I moved back to Atlanta and got into the restaurant franchising business. I acquired the rights for a Canadian restaurant franchise for three southern states, Georgia, Tennessee, and Alabama. I opened up a pilot store and within a year and a half filed corporate and personal bankruptcy, became a full-time actor, did really well in Atlanta, studied everything I could, moved to New York, and the phone rang one day and it was ESPN asking me if I wanted to audition for a job as color analyst. And I said, yeah, a regular paycheck would be a pretty good thing. What does the audition consist of? And they said, a live game on the air. And I went, ooh, and swallowed really hard. And I went to Chicago Stadium and did a game and won the audition and started a career as a broadcaster. And that's really how it started. The phone rang one day.
What year was this?
That was 1986.
Okay. All right. So you started nationally then?
Yeah. I started at the top and worked my way sideways and all over the place.
Okay. Because I became a Flyers fan when I was about 8 or 9 years old, and this was 1989, and you were already broadcasting with Mike Emmerich. So that's the start of Bill Clement as I know it.
Well, you know what happened? At ESPN, they would only give us a one-year contract, and the Flyers approached Doc Emmerich and myself to see if we would come and work for them. And we ended up with some security with a longer-term contract. So we left ESPN to go to the Flyers. I subsequently went back to ESPN. Doc didn't, but that's how we ended up with the Flyers.
Right. So now, speaking of Doc Emmerich, you know, nothing against your current partner, Jim Jackson, who's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
But Doc Emmerich and, you know, Gary Thorne, for that matter, are just two unbelievable play-by-play announcers that, you know, I mean, Gary Thorne, I haven't heard him do a game in quite a while, but every time, you know, the Flyers are on nationally, I get excited to hear Doc call the game again.
Yeah.
Can you just tell me what it's like working with him?
It was great working with both Doc and Gary. And it is Jim Jackson as well. First of all, it's great to work with people that you know are incredibly professional, that are prepared, that are articulate, that can bring a product that you know is universally accepted. So it really is cool to work with people that you consider to be elite, and that's what they all are. But I think there's one element that makes it easiest to work with those three guys, with Doc and with Gary and with Jim Jackson, and it's senses of humor. I find the broadcasters that I get tired of are guys that really take themselves too seriously, and so seriously that there's no room, you know, for a smile and a laugh. And you never want to turn a broadcast into a stand-up routine.
Sure.
But at the same time, I think fans want to listen to people that really have fun doing what they're doing. And when you can balance out having a sense of humor and really delivering a quality product and delivering the drama, the stories, and all of that, it makes for an incredible overall experience for fans. And Gary and I, we haven't worked together for years. I'd love to work with Gary again. And if the phone rang tomorrow, both Gary and I would do national, you know, telecasts in a heartbeat. Gary and I have talked about this often. The phone just hasn't rung.
Yeah, I have conversations with a friend all the time, and we just reference those, you know, late 90s, early 2000s game, you know, the Stanley Cup games. Every time, you know, something good happens on the Flyers, it's always a text that says, "Do you believe it? Do you believe it?" Which is the a nod to the Rangers Stanley Cup years. And, you know, so there's so many memories. The best game I've ever seen, I can tell you, was 2004. Game 6, Flyers Lightning, where they were a minute and a half from being knocked out. And if that video has 50,000 views on YouTube, I'm probably 40,000 of them, because I would just watch that over and over again.
Yeah.
And you see the puck in the corner, and Primo kind of gets in front of the net, and it slides across the crease. And you just hear you on the microphone, oh, and then it's just great.
You know what, Joey? That is the loudest I've ever heard the Wells Fargo Center.
Oh, for that goal.
And it's funny you should mention that game, because I got tickets for my son and daughter were 12, 13, 14, and they're only a year apart. And they were at that game, and that's an indelible memory for them as well. That game was sensational. The two games that stick out for me, there were so many of them, and that was one of them. But the two games that I considered a real privilege to be a part of, I shouldn't say limited to two, because there's so many. It's a privilege to be associated with the sport. But before you started watching seriously, 1987, when Doc Emmerich and I called Game 7 of the Patrick Division Series between the Islanders and the Capitals, they went to four overtimes. It was the Woodstock of hockey at the time. We got really punchy. I took my shirt off and tied
That's on YouTube as well.
Yeah, people still remember that. So that was an unbelievable memory. But Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Final in 1994, when the Rangers ended the curse, was remarkable. To say nothing of the double overtime games, the Stefan Matteau goals, that whole run of the Rangers because of the 50-year buildup was something we'll never see again, I don't think.
That was one of my questions, actually, because you called so many games, and I really wanted to know in your head what is something that we'll never see again. It sounds like that's the answer. Did you call the Game 7 Boston Flyer, when the Flyers were down 3-0 in the series? You did call that one?
Yeah, that was the first round of the playoffs, and the locals get the broadcast, and since I'm a Flyers broadcaster now, yeah, I did.
So I was flying for work on that game, so I watched the first period in the airport, and now they have Wi-Fi on planes, so you can track the game now, but you had to shut your phone off, and Boston was up 3-0 when I shut my phone off, and then you fly from Chicago to Philly. I'm thinking they lost, they're out of it, and then, the plane lands, I turn my phone on, I see 4-3. So that's how I watched that game. So, I'm sure that would have been number one had I seen it live, but, 2004 Tampa Bay series is still number one for me.
Yeah, there's so many great ones. And the Flyers have had, by themselves, so many great ones. I called the J.J. Daniel goal with Doc Emmerich in 87 or 88, when the Flyers forced the seventh game in the Stanley Cup Final. That was the loudest I'd ever heard the Spectrum. I mean, you don't have a sense of how loud a building is when you're a player, because you're in deep focus and you have your filters, working in your ears. Mm-hmm. But as a broadcaster, and very often we do this, and Gary Thorne would do this. I learned this from Gary. Gary's such a purist as far as his appreciation for sports, and he does baseball as well. But when I first started working with Gary, when we'd have big games and big things would happen, and we knew enough not to start talking right away, like if the hometown crowd was just going berserk, you let it breathe a little bit. I'd always see Gary do this. He'd take his headset off so we could hear the roar of the crowd just to have a sense of how loud it was. I thought, that's really neat. I'm not going to let the crowd be fed through audio to me by our soundboard guy down in the, on the audio portion of the truck. So I remember taking my headset off and saying, boy, that's so loud.
That's special behind the scenes right there. Now, you've recently become a U.S. citizen, which I think is fantastic.
Thank you.
We have the Olympics.
I hope I don't ruin it for the first 300 million U.S. citizens that got here ahead of me.
No, I don't think so. We have the Olympics coming up this year. Couple things I want to ask you. First, I have to ask you, now that you're U.S. now, are you going to side and root for the U.S. this year?
Boy, that's a toughie. Even before I became a U.S. citizen, I was asked that question, and in the Vancouver Olympics, I actually found myself cheering for Canada. I got to tell you that. But part of this involves who the players are that make the team. Because when people say, well, who do you cheer for? And I say, well, look, my allegiance has always been with the Flyers. I won 2 Stanley Cups there. But as far as cheering for teams, I cheer for people. And I got to know so many players as a national broadcaster over the years that I cheer for people. So very often I want them to do well. And they happen to play for St. Louis Blues or whatever, the LA Kings or something like that. So I have to wait and see the rosters. And I actually will probably have to start watching Canada playing the U.S. before I really have the answer to that question. No matter what my head tells me, my heart's going to announce what it really wants to do when the games are being played.
Okay. I'll have to accept that. I tried to trap you a little bit on that one.
No, honest truth, I wouldn't have a problem telling you. The last Olympics, I found myself cheering for Canada. This Olympics, I have no idea.
Okay. Now, what's your opinion in general of the NHL stopping for 3 weeks and, doing the Olympics?
Now, from a hockey standpoint, from an NHL standpoint, I think it's a great idea. I always look at what's best for the sport. And as long as the right teams do well, like Team USA and Team Canada, there's going to be a great following in the States. But at the same time, we're still trying to grow hockey in many of the European nations and other, you know, like everywhere from Germany to Austria to Norway to Switzerland, still trying to grow the sport. So from a hockey standpoint, I really like it. I have a great respect for the players that play because they're the ones that really sacrifice. Can you imagine what it's like playing an NHL season, stopping, flying to Russia, as it's going to be in February, playing those games there, coming back, playing in the NHL, maybe making the playoffs. You know, at the end of the season, these are the guys, I pay homage to the players that play because it is so demanding and they represent their countries with pride and with energy and with their blood and with their tears and all of that. So I like it happening. Part of my heart goes out to the players, but overall it's a good thing.
Right. I as a fan, I mean, before 2010, I think 2006, the games were in Sweden or somewhere where, you know, it was hard to watch the games live and they were on real early in the morning.
Right.
And it would annoy me that, you know, players on the Flyers could get injured by going to the Olympics. So I was kind of against it at first. But after seeing that last round in 2010, I mean, that was the best hockey I've ever seen. If you think about an NHL playoff game where, you know, every player's going on all cylinders and, you know, everything's just all these great saves happening, it's like that from the drop of the puck to the end of the game in the Olympics. And I just can't wait to see it again this year.
Joey, I got to tell you something. A lot of people say, watch the Olympics. This is why the NHL should go to the bigger rink. The one thing they don't Olympic-sized rink is 15 feet wider than an NHL rink, same length. The one thing they don't factor in is that it's the best players in the world playing in that big rink. The execution is second to none. So it wouldn't look the same, and you'd have hitting gone from our sport if everybody played on the big rink, because most players wouldn't be fast enough to get there to deliver the hit. And what happens is everybody just retreats into a shell. Believe me, the answer to any problem in the NHL is never going to be the bigger rink.
Okay. I hear you. Well, that's something I don't think about for sure. Now, out of all the wonderful things you've done in your career, playing, broadcasting, the number one thing I really want to ask you about is when you lent your voice to EA Sports, specifically the year 2000, because I had a Shorehouse that summer and we just played that game nonstop. Now, I'm sure John Madden was probably the first to have his voice in the game, but I didn't play that game. So to me, you were the first real announcer to be in a video game, and that was pretty revolutionary back in 2000.
Yeah.
I remember your quotes, you know, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, and, you know, so I'm kind of wondering how that process works. Do you just step into a recording studio and get a script and read it, or did you get to write your own lines? How did that whole thing unfold?
Well, for the last, I don't know, however many years, and by the way, EA Sports has discontinued Gary and myself, so get one of the 2000, I didn't even know if they're going to release the 2014 game with our voices, but we did record it. What we would do, Gary Thorne and I would go into our recording booth and we would just have a stack of paperwork that thick with situation after situation after situation described, such as a player on his knees just inside the blue line takes a wrist shot and it's going high to the glove side. Degree of difficulty, medium. They want five versions of that as if it were live. And then they say, on his knees inside the blue line, takes a wrist shot, right side high, degree of difficulty, medium. Then it would be halfway down the net, lower part of the net, degree of difficulty, low, degree of difficulty, high. And EA, and it was great to work with them. They're the greatest people. They want us to reinvent the wheel and come up with something different every time. And I can tell you, we only could do sessions that were 6 hours long, because after 6 hours of taxing your brain that way, it's... We couldn't put simple sentences together, and we get the giggles, and we couldn't work. So it's most of the stuff that you hear, almost all of it, is stuff that just it's improv. It comes out of our mouths. So that's the way it works. It's not scripted. It's not reading lines. We don't have any video to look at. It's pieces of paper. Gary sitting across from me, me sitting across from Gary, and just doing it. That's the way it's done.
I'm sure you can do this somehow, but I like to just press play and just hear all the lines isolated without the game. I've been out of the video game industry for a while. That's why I mentioned NHL 2000. I think you probably only had 5 to 10 lines that they would just repeat over and over again. But as technology gets better, you know, they can program when the guy's on his knees and taking a wrist shot. And yeah, I'm sure it's much more taxing now than it used to be.
Yeah, just a little.
Now, obviously, as a color commentator, you know, you need to be on top. Hockey fans in general are educated fans to begin with, and it's your job to educate them further. So you have a pretty crazy travel schedule with the Flyers and going on the road. How much time do you actually get to watch, like, St. Louis Blues versus the Columbus Blue Jackets and take in, you know, everybody's current status and what everybody's doing to deliver that information, you know, when the Flyers are playing those teams?
Actually, quite a bit of time. I mean, especially if you go into a city the night before and that team is playing and they're on TV, you naturally want to watch it. But you watch it on an as-needed basis. Now, with the NHL package, you can just click around and see whatever you want to see. And it's really important. Almost all of us try to watch at least one game of a team that we know is coming up, or the two opponents, depending on what kind of games we're doing. But you always want to get a sneak preview of line combinations, players in the lineup, and quite frankly, pirate any stories you can, you know, that other broadcasters use. I mean, if it's out there and there's a good story about a player, I mean, we all believe in reusing them if it's of interest. We never assume that the whole world has seen one game and heard everything. So, you know, you pick up, gain insights, pick up little storylines, coaching insights, team insights, injuries, all of those things. So I watch quite a bit, and I watch it on an as-needed basis, especially when there are teams coming up that I'm going to have to broadcast.
Right. Okay. Now, this year's Hall of Fame class was announced recently. Fred Shiro finally got his nod. But really, you know, from my time period, Eric Lindros was huge, you know, when I was in middle school and high school. And when he broke into the league, you know, you were the guy doing all the interviews, and, you know, you were always around. I've probably seen him play more than anybody. Do you think eventually he'll be in the Hall of Fame, or do you think his career just didn't have enough games to get him in there?
Oh, I think on merit, as a hockey player, he'll definitely make it to the Hall of Fame. And I think the only thing that will delay, if it does, is the fact that Eric and his family decided to be nonconformists in a world where everybody's expected to conform. I mean, when you're drafted by a junior team, you're expected to go there and play. Eric refused to go to Sault Ste. Marie, so he started bucking the system with his mother and father at a really young age. Then he gets drafted by the Quebec Nordiques. Ain't going to play there either, you know, and that's when the Flyers got in the bidding war with everybody, and he went to Philadelphia. So they really rubbed a lot of traditionalists the wrong way, and I think that there's an anti-Lindros bias with a lot of people because of that. And I can understand that, but if you're looking at just on ice contributions, performances, and overall stature, Eric definitely deserves to be in the Hall of Fame.
I guess, you know, I didn't even think of that because I don't know what the criteria is to get to the Hall of Fame. I just look at other players that are there, you know, like Pavel Bure, for example, unbelievable player, but when I compare him to Eric Lindros, it seems like a no-brainer to me.
You know what, Joey? Let me just say this. One of the criteria is being a credit to the game, you know, and I don't know the exact wording, but it's on and off the ice being a credit to the game. And I don't think that's necessarily consistently taken into consideration, and I don't think a player necessarily has to be a credit to the game, but the one thing that can happen is they can't discredit the game. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And human nature being what it is, I think the, you know, people and human sentiment and the Hall of Fame committee, you know, the induction committee, I don't think they can help but be influenced by someone that they may perceive to have off the ice because of, you know, all of the things that they did that were anti-establishment. I don't think they can help but factor that in.
Okay, well then, I guess he has a little bit of an uphill climb then, huh?
I think there's something pushing back. I think if anything's pushing back against him, that's what it is. But he'll get there. I mean, he was just too dominant. He did things that nobody else could ever do and possibly never will do with his size and his strength and his skill level. And, I mean, he was, and you know what? I don't care if it was a shortened season. He still won a Hart Trophy as an MVP in the 94-95 lockout shortened season, but nobody else won it but him. I don't care if it was a shortened season. An MVP is an MVP. There are a ton of guys in the Hall of Fame that never came close to winning a Hart Trophy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you do motivational speaking on the side. BillClementSpeaking.com is your website.
Yeah. It's actually not on the side because it keeps me as busy as anything.
Okay.
Just another one of the career paths I've chosen. And, I speak on leadership most of the time. I release my book, Everyday Leadership, and the subtitle is Crossing Gorges on Tightropes to Success. Wayne Gretzky was nice enough to write the foreword. And it's a passion I have. I've studied leadership. I've lived it. I failed at it. So that's what I do now. But the genesis of it's pretty interesting. It was my complete financial ruin and bankruptcy when I was in my mid-30s and being asked when I finally got my broadcasting and acting careers going to deliver a speech and talk about it. And you know what? Even then, I had a fear of public speaking equal to most people's. I've since overcome it and embraced the being in front of an audience, whether it's 70 or whether it's 700 or whether it's 1500. I really enjoy it, and it's one of the things in my life right now that makes my heart beat the fastest.
Yeah, is it the same kind of nervousness when you're on TV as it is speaking in front of 1,000 people?
It's probably the same as it is even being a player TV in front of people. It's that pre-performance, you know, the pre-performance jitters or the juice, you know, the adrenaline is flowing. It's absolutely the same. And similar to playing, broadcasting, or acting, it dissipates as soon as the curtain goes up.
Right.
As soon as I'm announced, and I'm kind of a pool of mush, you know, when the introduction is taking place, but as soon as I set foot on stage, it's showtime, baby.
Right.
Away we go.
Now,
I was a player.
I can imagine, you know, you go out to, do you do businesses in the Philadelphia region?
Absolutely.
I can imagine, you know, a guy comes in, he's like, has no idea what the lecture is going to be about and sits in the audience, and all of a sudden you come out and he's a rabid Flyers fan. Does it ever... You know, is that ever distracting to what you're doing?
They usually know ahead of time who they're coming to see. You know, there's some pre-publicity. And even a rabid Flyers fan has a sense of decorum to sit and enjoy the presentation. And believe me, I strive. I work really hard to make an hour seem like 10 minutes when I'm on stage because my presentations really move. I don't stay in one place physically or storytelling wise or subject matter wise. So it really is content rich the way I try to present. And it's great to have Flyers fans in the audience because they really appreciate the Flyers stories that I tell about the first time I tried to negotiate my contract with Keith Allen, about the respect that Fred Shiro had for his athletes and the sense of humor that hardly anybody knew that he really had. And the sacrifices that he made for his players, putting his own career in jeopardy. I tell stories about leaders that do things like that and about Bobby Clark, the greatest captain. I consider the greatest captain in the history of sports. And I didn't play with all of the other captains and all of the other sports, but I'd stack Clarky up against anybody. So Flyers fans in an audience are usually a pretty good thing for me.
Okay. I would imagine that. Now, I've been to the website.
Stand up in the middle of the presentation and go, "Yo, Clement!"
That's what I was thinking happens.
You know?
That's exactly.
You don't do that.
That's, you know, if it was me circa 2003, that's probably what I would have done. But I've matured a little bit in my older age.
Yeah, okay.
But No, I've been to the website and I've seen, you know, you have 5-minute videos of your presentation, you know, scattered throughout the website, and I've seen it, and it's just great. I mean, it's very motivational. I almost want the Flyers to hire you when they're in their season droughts a little bit.
Boy, if they get caught in one of those downward vortex that spins them down for a 10-game losing streak, my career would end as a speaker. You know what? Most of the players get this stuff, and I've spoken. I actually was hired a number of years ago, and I have spoken to front office people at the Flyers. Sean Tilger, the VP of Broadcasting and Marketing, has had me in a couple of times over the years. So my fingerprint is here and there in the Flyers organization, but I like to leave the motivating to the coaching staff and the players themselves, because that's who ultimately has to get it done.
For sure, but I mean, I definitely agree with that, but is there ever a time where a coach will bring an outside source, not saying it has to be you, but, right, you know, some if a message isn't getting through and he feels like he needs to do something, I don't know if it's somebody coming in and speaking, or, you know, sometimes they have those team building things they do in Whistler or whatever, you know, is that kind of thing involved? Like, what are some types of things that coaches can do to get focus back to the team?
I believe, depending on the structure of the team building exercises, I really believe in them, especially if you've got a group of guys that are just coming together. You know, a lot of changes in the off season, that type of thing. It just helps people get to know one another a little better and peel back the layers. I mean, everybody has some sort of facade, you know, that you have to break through little by little over a period of days, weeks, months to get to know them. You accelerate that process if you do a team building thing. Bringing somebody in for a one-time shot, I don't think it's all that effective when you're dealing with elite athletes. I remember the Flyers brought in he was a football player, motivational speaker, a number of years ago. And you'd know his name, but I'm not going to throw him under the bus. Almost all of the players after, because I was around the Flyers then, not playing, but I was around the Flyers, said, what was he like? And they all kind of went, whoa, you know, it was like big deal. You know, we didn't really get it. And I remember when the LA Kings brought in Tony Robbins to speak to the Kings back in 92. I think Barry Melrose was there then. And Wayne Gretzky didn't know what to make of it. He was in LA.
I would love to see that situation of Tony Robbins walking in and Wayne Gretzky, you know, scratching his head of what's going on.
Yeah.
Now, you've got a Twitter account, at BillClement10. And it's linked off your website, so I'm assuming you want people to go there. But I have to say, it looks like you haven't tweeted. You've only tweeted twice, and It hasn't been since 2012. Are we ever going to get more tweets from Bill Clement?
You think it's time, Joey?
Well, I think when this interview is posted, I think that should be what gets you back in there.
Yeah, okay.
No, I just, you know, I would be into it. I'm big on Twitter, and I love to see what, you know, athletes and I just feel it's a good outlet for people, you know, outside of what they do normally.
Yeah. With this little push that you've given me, stay tuned.
Okay. All right.
Stay tuned.
Now, final thing we have here, Flyers made some significant moves in the off season.
Yeah.
You know, offense, defense, goalie. Can you just give your Bill Clement assessment of what they've done? Have they just got themselves as a contender, or have that, you know, are they more than that now?
It's really, first of all, I think the moves have been really good. They were kind of a dysfunctional group, I think, a little bit. I mean, Ilya Brizgalov was just like almost too different a guy. Not a bad human being, but just too different to blend.
I don't want to interrupt you, but since you brought his name up, you know, was he different? Did you get a chance to talk to him at all when he wasn't? The only time I get to see him is when he has cameras on him, and you know, you go to the website and you watch the interviews, but you never really know what the guy was like when the cameras weren't on him. Did you ever get a chance to talk to him?
Yeah.
Is he the same guy?
Yeah.
Okay.
Pretty cool. Sort of non-connective, you know, so you couldn't really. You couldn't really figure out if you were talking to the real Briz or, you know, the on-camera Briz, or like, will the real Briz please stand up kind of thing. So that's hard for a team, you know, especially somebody that was so in the public eye. I mean, after 24/7 that first year, it was just a really weird situation that seemed to follow the Flyers around with Briz. So, you know, I think there was almost addition by subtraction, and I think the team is going to have much better chemistry moving forward. Personnel-wise, you know, Ray Emery was accepted by the guys when he was here. He just set a record last year for most consecutive wins at the start of a season. He knows how to stop pucks. Matter of fact, partway through the season, the Chicago Blackhawks, it was like Crawford or Emery, right? Crawford or Emery. Who's going to be the guy in the playoffs?
Yeah, exactly.
And with Steve Mason, I don't think the Flyers want Steve Mason to be the number one guy just yet. He's got to regain his confidence. You know, he lost a lot of it in Columbus. So Emery's used to platooning, sharing time. Steve Mason's got no problem with it. His sights are set on being number one. He's going to try to build himself back up. I love Mark Streit. He's a power play guy. He was a captain. I don't care that he's 34 or 35. Defensemen can live a lot longer in the NHL than forwards can. So he's immediately got the hardest shot from the blue line. He's a quality power play guy and puck mover, and that's what the Flyers need. Kimmo Tiininen's probably going to play this year, and then that's it. Right, he's got a one-year deal.
Right.
Need to have a guy like Mark Streit. Who else are we talking about?
Well, I know one thing on Streit. I know of his offensive capabilities. I looked at his stats. You know, I've seen him play, but you know, they had a lot of problems on defense this year. Is he good on defense? I guess is the question.
Yeah, you know, like anything else, if you wanted to find a Nick Lidstrom, you'd have to look forever. Mark is a better offensive player than a defensive player. But, you know, you pair a guy like that with Luke Shen, you know, and say to Luke, just stay at home, mm-hmm. and, you know, bang bodies and clear. That's why, you know, defense work in pairs, not necessarily as individuals. Is he a better offensive player than a defensive player? Absolutely. Do you have to score goals to win? Absolutely. Is it still important to keep pucks out of your net? Sure it is. But at some point, you've got to look at your team as a giant puzzle and figure out what pieces you need to fit where.
Okay. And so, I guess...
You're leaving somebody out.
LeCave, yeah.
Oh, Vinny, of course. Of course. To me, this was an unbelievable move. I'm a big Danny Briere fan, but the cap hit was $6.5 million for Danny for 2 years. They only owed Danny a total of $5 million, and they can pay a fraction of that off. So financially, it didn't cost the organization much money. By buying Danny out, they got rid of 6.5 each year of the next 2 years off the salary cap. They bring in Vinny. He's as skilled as Danny. He's 5 inches taller, maybe 40, 45 pounds heavier, and is combative and is a competitor. And Vinny at times seemed to have lost that competitive edge in the last few years. But Joey, trust me when I tell you, no player signs with the Flyers that doesn't want to compete. They know that if you come to Philadelphia, you are going to have to be a blood and guts kind of guy because that's what the organization demands of you and what the fandom, what the city demands of you. So I'm so anxious to see Vinny LeCavalier in a Flyers uniform.
Yeah, you got me all amped up. It's July.
One last thing. The Vinny's making 4.5. The Flyers saved $2 million on their cap hit with LeCavalier.
Yeah, I try not to think about the Briere thing because... You know, I used to get annoyed about people in the regular season that would just kill this guy because he was a playoff player and he never, even the year, I think it was 2009 where the Flyers got knocked out in the first round, he even, you know, did his point per game production in that series. He never had a bad playoff when he was with the Flyers and, you know, so... I guess I hope they don't face Montreal in the playoffs is what I'm saying.
Well, I hear you. But if you think about that move, if you look at it as LeCavalier replacing Danny, fans here will never forget Danny. He'll be loved here forever, as he should be. But thinking with your head and not your heart, as a business person, if you were trying to run a hockey team, this would have been a move that made all the sense in the world to you.
Yeah, and I'm happy to take a Tampa Bay player because I have a theory that when they play Tampa in Tampa, their goal horn is the most intimidating goal horn in the league. And once Tampa gets that first goal and the goal horn goes off, that's it. I mean, their record's horrible in Tampa Bay.
Yeah. Good point.
Yeah. So, Bill, I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. Hopefully you get your Twitter back up and running. That's at BillClement10, and people can follow you there. And BillClementSpeaking.com. check it out. I really appreciate anything I'm forgetting.
Oh, man. And listen, this is your show, brother, not mine. And I really enjoy doing this. I know we've been trying to work this out for months, and I will give you full marks for continuing to claw your way into making this happen. And you were very persistent, and I respect that in anybody. So well done by you.
Thank you so much. All right, Bill. We'll see you in October.
Okay, Joey. All right. See you, bye.